Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. This is Dr. Michael Eggener, and I have the privilege of guest hosting today. My guest today, and this is the second of our discussions, is Dr. Edward Faser, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Pasadena City College in Pasadena, California. Dr. Faser is a prolific writer and a superb writer. He's written many books on Aristotelian and Thomistic philosophy, and his most recent book, Aristotle's Revenge, I have read. It is a wonderful and profound book, and I have the pleasure of having Dr. Faser here to speak with us today. Welcome, Ed.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Ed, what would Aristotle say about evolution?
Wow. Well, that's a big question. Of course, Aristotle himself was around, you know, centuries or millennia before Darwin. So though he was familiar with the general idea of evolution because the idea had been around in pre-Socratic philosophy, he didn't accept it. And he, of course, wouldn't have been familiar with the whole modern evolutionary synthesis that's developed with Darwin and in the years since Darwin's time. So what he might have said about it had he been familiar with modern developments is anyone's guess. I suppose what's a more interesting and important question is what Aristotelians, contemporary followers of Aristotle, would say about it. And one of the things I argue in my book, in the chapter on biology, is that while, of course, being an Aristotelian does not require believing in evolution, after all, Aristotle was an Aristotelian, but he didn't think of biology in terms of evolution. At the same time, I argue that Aristotelianism is not incompatible with evolution. You could adapt Aristotelian philosophy of nature to a broadly evolutionary account of the origins and development of life. And if anything, evolution itself, I argue, at least in very general terms, actually presupposes the truth of some broadly Aristotelian themes, in particular, essentialism and teleology.
What do you think, from your perspective and from an Aristotelian perspective, that Darwin got right, and what do you think that he got wrong?
Well, what I do in the book, if I sort of focus on what I actually have to say in the book, I don't get in any sort of detail to specific controversies over the evolutionary explanation of this or that particular life form. What I'm interested in the book is the general philosophical question of whether a broadly evolutionary account of life is compatible with a broadly Aristotelian philosophy of nature and metaphysics. And I argue that they are indeed compatible. It's often claimed that they're not. It's often claimed that somehow if you're an Aristotelian, you have to reject evolution. I don't think that's true. There are different reasons why people say this. So for example, they'll say that Aristotle himself thought that there was no transition from one species to another, which is certainly true. But of course, Aristotle thought all kinds of things that people no longer accept. For example, Aristotle thought that the universe had no beginning in time. He thought it's always been here. He also thought, of course, that there's always been a divine unmoved mover who's kept it going from moment to moment, as long as the universe has been here, which is always. But because he thought the universe has always been here, he also thought that human beings have always been here, that dogs and cats have always been here, that trees, grass, and so forth have always been here. And because he thought that, he didn't think there was any special need to account for where they came from. And so there was no pressure, intellectual pressure, philosophical or scientific pressure, for him to come up with an evolutionary story or to take very seriously an evolutionary story. Of course, now, in light of the Big Bang model of cosmology and so forth, there is a need to take that sort of story seriously. And so there's a need for an Aristotelian to address the question of whether an evolutionary account can be reconciled with Aristotelianism. But insofar as that's one of the, you know, the bases people have for saying that there's some incompatibility, I would say that's it. The problem with that assumption is just that the idea that the universe had no beginning is not essential to a broadly Aristotelian philosophy. It's something Aristotle himself happened to believe, but it's not something that's essential to being an Aristotelian. I would also add, if you wanted me to expand on this, that, you know, there are other objections people raise. So people sometimes say things like, well, doesn't the Aristotelian view hold that the forms of things or the essences of things are fixed, that they don't change? And yet, doesn't evolutionary theory entail that the forms or essences of things do change, that forms can change or that essences can change? And if that's the case, is there some incompatibility? I would say that's a fallacy. What the evolutionist does say, or at least what the evolutionist should say, I'm sure there are, you know, evolutionists who say things to the effect that essences or forms change. But I would say that's just a sloppy way of describing it. It's not that the forms or essences, like the form or essence of being a reptile somehow changes or morphs into the form or essence of being a bird or something. That's not what, I mean, I'm sure there are evolutionists who say that, but that's not what they should say, and that's not what they need to say. What they should say is rather that a population of creatures that, say, had the form or essence of being a reptile gave rise to a population that had a different form or essence, namely the form or essence of being a bird. That's very different from saying that the essence itself changes, or the form itself changes. One can ask questions about the mechanism of that and how that might have happened, but it's not a question of the form or essence itself changing. That's not something that the evolutionists need say or ought to say.
But if one is an essentialist and believes that things really do have essences, wouldn't there have to be an inflection point at which cows become whales or something of that sort? And wouldn't that inflection point be a violation of essentialism? At some point, one organism has to go from being one thing to being another, and it has to happen in an organism, one individual.
Well, it's not necessarily a violation. It all depends on how you spell out the mechanism of it. So, for example, to take an inorganic example, we all know that you can get hydrogen and oxygen out of water, and you can get water from hydrogen and oxygen. Now, water is one kind of substance. Hydrogen and oxygen are very different kinds of substance. But the hydrogen and oxygen are contained, as Aristotelian philosophers would put it, they're contained virtually in the water, even though they're not actually there. You can get hydrogen and oxygen out of water, and so you're getting one substance, and so a substance of one kind of essence from another substance with a very different kind of essence. But that doesn't violate essentialism. So in the same way, the bare idea of, say, getting one type of organism from another type of organism does not by itself violate essentialism. Now, there's the question, somebody might ask, what's the mechanism by which that happens? Because we know the mechanism by which you can get hydrogen and oxygen from water and so forth. That's a fair question. My only point is just that merely appealing to essentialism doesn't by itself settle the matter. I think that assumption that you can just settle it by saying, well, if you're an essentialist, you have to rule out evolution, that's too quick. That doesn't follow.
There's a book called What Darwin Got Wrong by Jerry Fodor and Massimo Piattelli Palminarini.
Yeah.
And then I thought it was an excellent book. And they described natural selection, the concept of natural selection, as empty. In other words, that natural selection wasn't a level of explanation. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I have a lot to say about them and their book in my own book. And their book is one for which I have a lot of respect. I agree with you. It's an excellent book. It got, no surprise, attacked at the time it came out. Fodor, in particular, was quite vigorous in responding to the criticisms. And as far as I'm concerned, I think all his responses to the criticisms were solid responses. And I think a lot of people missed Fodor's point. Fodor, of course, died, a couple of years ago. Fodor is a pretty hardcore atheist. I think in the book they put it by saying they're fully paid up, card-carrying atheist secularists or whatever, right? They've got this cute little description. And so he says, my criticisms of Darwinism are not based on any sort of sympathy for intelligent design or anything like that. He just simply thinks there's a conceptual problem with the idea that natural selection provides any sort of explanation. Specifically, in their view, and Fodor's view in this book, What Darwin Got Wrong, Fodor thinks that natural selection per se, natural selection just considered by itself as a kind of impersonal process. And of course, the whole point of Darwin's idea of evolution by natural selection is to try to explain the origin of species and the adaptedness of organisms to their environment in a way that makes no reference to any sort of mind, any sort of intellect, any sort of design, anything like that. But he thinks that natural selection cannot account for the fact that, say, an organism like he gives the example of polar bears, that they're selected for, say, being white as opposed to being selected for being indistinguishable from their environment, blending into their environment. He thinks there's a kind of indeterminacy problem, as philosophers like to call it, in the very mechanism of natural selection. He thinks that there's got to be a fact of the matter about whether polar bears are adapted, are selected for being white or for blending into their environment, but that natural selection itself can't account for that precisely because natural selection is an impersonal process. Unlike something with a mind, which can select for something precisely for the sake of its being white or for the sake of its being blending into its environment. Natural selection is an impersonal process, can't do that. Now, the lesson Fodor draws from this, he says, well, look, if you're going to be an evolutionist, but you're also, like Fodor is, going to be an atheist, then you've got a problem because you can't explain how it is that natural selection selects for this trait rather than some other trait. And so he ends up concluding that natural selection doesn't really explain anything. And there's this deep conceptual problem facing the whole Darwinian theory. As I argue in the book, that's too quick a conclusion. There is a middle ground position according to which if you affirm the existence of something we talked about in our first podcast, namely intrinsic or built-in teleology in nature, the way an Aristotelian would, then you could interpret natural selection as itself a kind of teleological process that aims towards certain outcomes. That would give you the conceptual machinery for adding a kind of determinacy to natural selection that Fodor thinks is not there and that you could bring in only if you appeal to some sort of divine mind, which he doesn't want to do. So basically what I do in the book is I use Fodor's argument as a kind of defense of Aristotelianism as applied to understanding, interpreting evolution.
If you're ascribing purpose to natural selection, which that seems to, isn't that just a kind of intelligent design?
Well, as we talked about in the first podcast, we have to draw a distinction, or at least Aristotelians would say we have to draw a distinction between intrinsic or built-in teleology or purpose on the one hand, and on the other hand, extrinsic or externally imposed teleology, where, as I noted in that first podcast, an example of that would be, say, the way that a vine, like the kind of vine Tarzan swings around in the jungle, the way that the vine has a built-in tendency to sink roots into the ground and take water in through them, that's a kind of built-in teleology. The vine has a built-in tendency toward that sort of outcome. Whereas if Tarzan takes a bunch of those vines and transforms them into a hammock, stitches them together into a hammock, the function of serving as a hammock is an externally imposed or extrinsic sort of teleology or purpose. Now, extrinsic or externally imposed teleology directly implicates a mind, in that case, Tarzan's mind. But intrinsic or built-in teleology for the Aristotelian does not make any sort of direct reference to a mind. Can you argue from the existence of that sort of teleology to the existence of a mind, in particular a divine mind? I think you can, and that's exactly what Aquinas does. And Aquinas, of course, is a follower of Aristotle. That's what Aquinas does in the fifth of his five ways. But that would require some further argumentation. Intrinsic or built-in teleology doesn't directly implicate a guiding mind or intellect in the way that extrinsic or externally imposed teleology, the kind that exists in artifacts, would directly implicate the existence of a mind or an intellect. So at least in principle, a Darwinian could acknowledge some kind of intrinsic or built-in Aristotelian teleology and bracket off the question of whether there's some divine mind behind it. As a Thomist, as a follower of Aquinas, I do in fact think that all natural teleology, including that would be implicated in this interpretation of evolution that I'm talking about, would point to a divine mind. But that's a secondary question. You could bracket off the question of whether the teleology is there from what the question of whether it requires a divine mind to guide it. Those are separable questions from the Thomistic point of view.
Do you feel that the design inference can be of heuristic help in understanding biology? Is there any place for the design inference in biological research?
Well, as you probably know from my own work on this subject, and indeed what I say in Aristotle's Revenge, where I revisit some of these themes, Aristotelians, including myself, and Thomists, including myself, often disagree with intelligent design writers on this question, in particular about whether the concept of design is really the best way to approach explanations in biology. What I would say is that the notion of teleology, the notion of goal-directedness, and related notions like the notion of biological function are indeed indispensable to biology, and I think they're irreducible. I don't think, for reasons I talk about in the book, I don't think that you can reduce the notion of biological function to just patterns of efficient causation the way a lot of contemporary materialist philosophers think you can. I don't think you can ultimately cash out or eliminate teleological notions from biology the way a lot of materialists think you can ultimately translate them out or they're ultimately dispensable. I think that's an error. So I think that teleological ideas and the notion of function are definitely indispensable in biology. But I would say it's a secondary question whether the notion of teleology has to be cashed out in terms of some kind of design in the sense of a mind which directs things to their ends. The end of the day, I think that's true, but that's a secondary question from whether the notion of teleology is crucial in biological investigation.
Well, I thank you very much, Ed. And to our listeners, if you want to understand the Aristotelian perspective on biology, Ed Fezzer's book, Aristotle's Revenge, is the best way I know how to do it. So I thank you, Dr. Fezzer, and I appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.